Of course, since the Indians did not have a name, there may easily have been two different men involved, possibly even the convict who had escaped from the jail at Letitia. I searched for Ludwig Palmen all over South America in 1968 and 69 and again in 1971 and 72. He was moving around Peru in 1968 and then disappeared. I also looked for him in West Germany in 1977 and 78 but failed to find any productive lead. The West German passport office had nothing on him. I could not get a line on him but never gave up searching. When Lou Farish heard of this book, Cancer Planet Mission from Colin Borden, discovered it set in an area he knew I was familiar with, he asked me what I knew or could find out about such a case for him. I wrote back and told him what I already knew up to that time, and that I had never caught up to Palmen though I had looked for him in Peru and West Germany. Lou responded by sending me a copy of the book. Imagine my surprise to find that this was in fact the story that I had been chasing in 1967, 66 and 69, and the reason I didn't make contact in Peru was because the man had no office there, and I didn't find him in Germany because, though German by birth, he had become an English citizen and was traveling on an English passport and working for an English company. Another coincidence was that Richard Greenwell was an English citizen living on an English passport and was working for an English enterprise in Lima. As I read this book, I was again struck by the mysterious phenomenon of synchronicity so often encountered in UFO investigations. I have personally been in many of the places described in this book, and some of them at the same time as Ludwig Palmen. We could easily have eaten in the same places at the same time. I had stayed in both the Krillin Hotel, where they have the best ceviche de Corbino in the world, and the Savoy Hotel, where they have a cozy cocktail lounge. In 47 to 69 I have been to other places mentioned in Palmen's story too, and I can personally vouch for the accuracy of the descriptions. This man was actually there in person and knew his way around. Having now read the manuscript through, I could see where Palmen had covered his tracks in the newspaper interview with the Lima Reporter. He was doing the same thing I'd had to do on occasion to protect my own Indian friends from unwanted disturbance, and to keep the story simple. He had associated the location with the Peruvian town of Iquitos because you could never get to the plantation site from Iquitos by river, and the jungle there was all but impassable. He had omitted all of the earlier contacts with the Atibians as well as what was going on in Lima and elsewhere, probably to head off possible interference for them as the operation was still going on. The story I was pursuing now was much more complete and more in accord with other similar stories around the world. But the most important thing to me now is having personally approached what may have been the ancient lost city sought by Percy Fawcett and mentioned to Palmen by the Atibians. They called it Linilan. That experience came about in a very strange way. Synchronicity again? I was on my way back to Lima and Antofagasta in my own twin-engined Lockheed Learstar in 1972, and had carried my friendly elders to Ecuador to leak for a huge pyramid on the east side of the Andes Mountains. We had parked the Learstar at Guayaquil and I went up to Cuenca with Lee to help him get his expedition together and to see him off. In the middle of this, the country went through an armed revolution and my Learstar at Guayaquil was shot up in the airport battle and put out of commission. I had to stay in Cuenca and join Lee in his expedition. While we were getting ready was when I investigated the UFO landing along the Azogues River. We found Lee's Pyramid Mountain with a 300-foot-high temple near the top, on the east face, and a round dome on top of that. In a society that historically did 1719 not know the science of setting a keystone and built their arches with stepped lintels. This structure clearly predated all known ruins in South America except possibly Tiahuanacu. Here again, the local Indians told us of seeing the ships of the brothers from the sky, and that sometimes the crowning dome of the temple structure seemed to glow with its own light, like in the darkness of the frequent night thunderstorms. In deference to our Jivaro friends who live around it, we have promised not to reveal its exact location. But it was here that we learned of a great abandoned and overgrown city in the jungles to the south, which was old beyond all tribal legends. Nobody knew when this city was ever occupied or by whom. This great city is not over 400 miles northwest of Iquitos and on almost a direct line from the three Itibi plantations in the south, on the Miriman Yacaile River sites in Peru and the Porcatumba plantation in Bolivia, up to the Magdalena River plantation in Colombia, and it is in the dense jungles of southern Ecuador. It covers over 20 square miles area and is completely overgrown with vegetation and cannot be seen from the air. On the ground, however, the evidence is quite unmistakable. The fractured boulevards are lined with tumble-down and overgrown remains of houses, public buildings and temples, some of considerable size. There are some features the which completely defy explanation. From a large stone hemisphere near the river, a single stone the size of a small house, completely covered with undeciphered inscriptions, one can see of the northeast about a mile away, a giant stepped pyramid, and 90 degrees around to the right in the southeast, and about the same distance away, one can make out the tops of three huge stone steels set in perfect geometrical formation and covered on both sides with the strange symbols like those on the round stone. Some of the most unusual features that seemed to have no logical explanation at all. It was found along the side of the great cobbled boulevard some distance from the public central plaza. This was a formation of three huge 200 diameter circles, flat as a tabletop and raised a few feet above the ground level. They were perfectly spaced 120 degrees apart on a common center, and they were only separated by about 100 feet, with two of them paralleling the road and about 100 feet back. Each of these huge flat circular platforms had three geometrically spaced depressions an equal distance from the center and 120 degrees apart. All of these depressions were identical and were of uniform size about 4 feet in diameter and several inches deep. These circles could have been theater stages or some kind of game court, but they were out in the open, alone, with no other building structures nearby. In response to my usual questions about UFOs, these Indians were familiar with them and saw them at times in all generations, even over the city ruins. Could these platforms have been used for public landings of circular craft which descended and ascended vertically? Indeed, that seemed then, and still seems today, to be the only logical explanation for this feature. Now, in this manuscript, I read that the extraterrestrials from Itibi actually went to and searched such ruins for a certain symbol. How many great cities of this kind lie there abandoned and overgrown in the Amazon jungle? A great curiosity indeed. This story certainly is not fiction to me, and it should not be to any sincere student of the UFO phenomenon. Remember that Palman was not known as a UFO fan and carried no such literature around with him, yet his story contains many of the pattern keys of significant UFO contact cases. I submit this story, which I have reason to consider real and legitimate, to you for your personal study and evaluation. If you do not agree with me, I am sure that you will at least find that the principles of the Itibians are sound and worthy of emulation. Although it has been over 15 years since the time of this story, the Indians who worked the plantations will still live round there and may even have kept the plantations up. And then, the Itibians may have come back by now and resumed their work. At any rate, there should be plant stocks from Itibi Ra still growing in what is left of the plantations. I have been unable still to locate Ludwig F. Palman since encountering the rest of his story, and I invite him or anybody who knows him or his whereabouts to get in touch with me at the address in this book as soon as possible to make some arrangements to coordinate information. We are interested in pinpointing the locations of the four Itibian plantations in South America with a view to examining the conditions of the plant stocks now. We are prepared, in return, to take Ludwig Palman with us on our next visit to the ruins of the ancient abandoned city, which just may be the city called Linilan visited by the Itibians when Palman was taken with them on that trip. We are also interested in the sequel manuscript which, up to now, may not have been published. If anybody has a copy of, or knowledge of, this manuscript, we invite them also to get in touch with this publisher. Wendell C. Stevens. We offer the book Cancer Planet Mission exactly as it was published in its original form, without alterations of corrections of any kind. We have sought for years to contact Ludwig Paulmann, and also the original printers, the Foster Press of London, both equally unsuuccessful, the Foster Press having been out of business for years according to our London contact. Nor have we been able to get a line on Paulmann. We have resorted to this move in an attempt to make connection with one or the other or both. We have added appendices following the book. Foreword Cancer Planet Mission, the introduction to a series of books about cosmophilosophy has to be considered a revolutionary literary work. Ever since a young man, with a pacifist heart, escaped the Gestapo and found refuge in England, the most shattering events have happened in his life. Recently, the leading London newspaper The Guardian, under the headline, "To Peru from Space," reported, "I Mr. Paulmann, the author, was doing food research for the Agricultural University of Lima, Peru, in order to find an inexpensive high-protein food. He hit on arrowroot as a binding agent, whilst biological research near the upper Amazon River. And here begins what some reporters call the greatest cosmic story ever told. We are faced with the undeniable fact that God has created man not just on one particular planet. There are far superior men and women on other planets, superior not in pride, contempt and hypocrisy, but in health, respect and happiness. Friends of cosmophilosophy believe it to be absurd that God should only be concerned with one particular faith and with only one particular planet. There is this spiral galaxy of Andromeda. It is one of a million galaxies and consists of several million suns. Most of these suns may have created billions of planets similar to ours. There, the author tells us, with the same endeavor, as on our planet, he human animal has murdered God and their fellow human beings, but also many civilizations have reached the higher form of development, the true biological age. On such planets the usual glory and power seekers, warmongers, the god of myth, fear and superstition no longer exist. Cosmophilosophy tells about the wisdom of these people and their courage to new faith. How they survived the greatest disasters. 29:31:6 Cancer Planet Mission. How they developed their amazing spacecrafts in order to settle on other planets. How they achieved happiness and a longer span of life. How they finally made peace between themselves and God. Mr. Paulmann's diary speaks with enthusiasm of the amazing central energy generation of their spacecraft, but most longingly he talks about their cosmophilosophy, which has long replaced the hypocrisies and superstitions of the less developed planets. Our ethics are based on love, compassion, reincarnation, threats of hell and a general theological pattern fixed and stiffened by dogmas thousands of years old. Their pattern or the future pattern for religion is based on mutual respect, and because of this code, he was told that most advanced civilizations on other planets are not at all the monsters pictured by science fiction, but they are cheerful and humble people of great intelligence. They believe that God does not punish, nor offer specific commandments, but that God is nature and their philosophy is determinist too, and they know that in time when they have gone even further ahead, we shall arrive where they are now and abolish wars, as they have, and with them superstitions and factional religions. Mr. Paulmann has managed, if putting pen to paper, to write an enthralling and stimulating book which is not only very readable but has given us the message of a revolutionary futuristic pattern of life. Cosmophilosophy. Chapter 1. I Meet Satura. The cosmic story of Amat Mena begins in London, not that London, swinging or prosaic, depending upon how old you are and how you look at it, played much of a part in the shattering events that were to befall me. But it so happened that I was in London at the time, going about my lawful occasions in the normal course of my business. My business, loosely speaking, is the sale and the installation of heavy machinery used in the large-scale production of food, for example, milling assemblies for the fine grinding of cereals on a vast program. One was visiting London at the time, for my business makes me a perpetual globetrotter. It chanced that I was in London on that first day of October, 1964. I was taking a breather, a brief pause in a heavy Latin American itinerary, and also making the necessary arrangements for the next part of my schedule. India, as I recall it, the weather that Thursday morning was fine. The sun still had warmth in it, although there was a hint of approaching autumn. The streets, as usual, were packed as I made my way from the Strand Palace Hotel to India House, where I made application for a visitor's visa to visit India. The business was conducted in a very agreeable fashion with a youngish official, who wished me well and hoped that I would find it a viable proposition to install in the future a battery of machinery for cereal grinding. As he put it, anything that would help to solve India's chronic food problem, any kind of technical improvement would be welcome. After lunch, I set about making the necessary travel arrangements. Here I met my first snag. I could not get an immediate direct flight. As I didn't want to cool my heels too long in London, I settled for an alternative route, which meant that I had something like 36 hours to kill. I passed the time boning up on India, for it was years since I had last visited that huge subcontinent. In the upshot, the flight was without interest. The last leg was from Tehran to Calcutta, and I landed at Dumdum Airport round about midday, the 4th of October. Although I had been to India before, I had never been to Dumdum Airport. It has to be seen to be believed. My first impression of it was that of a madhouse at carnival time. It was a broigle brought slap into the middle of the 20th century and set in the heat of India. I had to force a way through the teeming crowds that thronged the concourse. There were people waiting to emplane, people waiting for incoming flights, and people just waiting. People, people, people. People of all ages. People of all shapes and sizes. People of all colors and nationalities. No wonder, I thought, as I made my way to a taxi, that India had a food problem. As I settled in the taxi, and told the driver to take me to the Oberon Grand Hotel, I remembered a story I had heard several years before. It is a story about people meeting. It is alleged that if three Frenchmen got together for lunch, then they would have started a new political party before the time they had reached their coffee. If three Germans meet, then they form a protection society, and the first resolution they pass is one calling upon heaven to protect them from the competition of Japanese gadgetry. Similarly, three Spaniards would form a company to manufacture crystal chandeliers, whilst three Americans would immediately form a luncheon club and set about drafting menus for the next meetings. But if three Indians met, they would at once call in another 30 Indians and organize a religious festival in honor of their gods. I thought of this anecdote as the taxi weaved its honking way through the crowded streets. There were obvious signs of the Indian's preoccupation with his gods. I even saw a cow bring traffic to a halt just before the taxi screeched to a stop outside the Oberon Grand Hotel. The Oberon Grand is something left over from the spacious days of the British Raj. If one were asked to give my impression of the Oberon Grand in a few words, then I would have to say that, for me, it stands as the citadel for the modern cult of servility. The Oberon Grand is vast by any standards. It never seems to have many guests in it at any one time, or, rather, there is always room to move. But however many guests there are, they are always outnumbered by the servants. I don't know the exact ratio of servants to guests, but at an estimate, I should say that there are anything from 5 to 8 servants to each guest in the hotel. Now, for the man who lives out of a suitcase, this surfeit of servants poses an immediate problem. Tipping. I think I am a bit of an expert on tipping, as I've tipped my way round the world on many occasions. Some say that the word originates in France, and comes from pourboire. This means showing satisfaction for services rendered by giving the servant some money in order to buy a drink. Others say that the word derives from the initial letters of three other words, to ensure promptness. This means that you buy quick service by greasing the servant's palm with money. Whatever the origin of the word, a traveler staying in an hotel is still expected to tip, despite the 10% that is often added to the bill as a service charge. I've tipped in many strange places, but I've never tipped as one was expected to tip in India. Here, you are ranked according to the way you tip. A smallish tip, and you are a Maharaja, or at least a Mahatma. A bigger dip, and you are a Mandarin, a veritable saint. Of course, if you don't give any tip at all, then you're a dirty, mean louse, and you have to get your drinking water for yourself. In India you hear the word backsheesh 100 times a day. You have to use your own judgment whether or not you do give a tip. The starving, wide-eyed, unsmiling children of India make you think twice before you give anybody a tip, and they make you wonder why you up at all. Certainly, in this country you never give a fat man a lip. I quickly found this out, as I just as quickly found out about the real value of money, and of life. You have to learn the art of giving the right amount of money to the right people at the right time, otherwise you would be everlastingly tipping. This was my philosophy, a materialistic philosophy, I must admit, as I went about my business in Calcutta, but I found, as I went from contact to contact, that this appeared to be the normal Indian way of life. As I moved about the business quarter of Calcutta, so I was impressed by the sheer number of people I saw. I knew that India, like China, was undergoing a population explosion, but I was not prepared for the milling crowds that thronged the streets at all hours of the day and night. They weren't happy crowds. Indeed, they did not look well-fed crowds. It is common knowledge that the vastly increase in world population is making rapid inroads into the dwindling food reserves available to Earth. Some people, some governments are doing all they can to grapple with the problem. Here in India, everybody, from high government official to the lowliest of workers, seems overwhelmed by inertia, so that they were unable to do anything positive to ameliorate the acute conditions of want that prevail. Never in all my life have I seen a place like India that is screaming out for swift, efficient organization in order that people might survive, let alone enjoy a decent standard of living. And as I went from one businessman to another in the few days that he spent in Calcutta, one thought I saw the main reason why there was this inertia, this attitude of fatalism. It is linked with bureaucratic red tape, but, above all, with religion. Now I'm not one to knock organization and administration if it serves some useful function. Although I'm not what you might call an orthodox religious person, yet I hope I respect the religious beliefs of others. I suppose you might call this the live and let live part of my basic philosophy. But out here in India I saw a country that was being strangled by its own bureaucratic red tape, a country that was dying because of its religious fatalism. I'm not exaggerating when I make these, admittedly, sweeping charges. In all my wanderings over the face of the globe, in all my dealings with businessmen and with government officials, one have never met such finicky insistence on protocol, such cultivated bureaucracy for the sake of bureaucracy, such skepticism and superstition as one have encountered in India. I not only met intransigent officials and also immovable businessmen. I came up against half-gods, saints, spirits and, inevitably, the holy animals by the thousand. It staggered me that it was no sin in India to let a child die of starvation. But it was a mortal sin to kill a sacred animal, even if that sacred animal was the very lowly rat, as it very often was. My good intentions towards the Indians and their food problem very soon dwindled to a resigned, albeit sentimental, detachment. Perhaps attachment is the better word, for although I could not make any progress with my business plans, yet I did become very much attached to India, and also, despite their inertia fatalism, to many of the Indians with whom I came into contact. But it was the attachment of the tourist and of the sightseer, not of the technician wanting to sell machinery. Not the attachment of an involved human being wanting to do something for starving people. After a few days of this hitting my head against the brick wall of Indian bureaucracy and religious fatalism, I decided that Calcutta was no place for me. After all, I had come all this way to India with a business proposition. I had not come as an idle spectator of the Indian scene, a rubbernecking tourist. So I checked out of the Oberon Grand Hotel, having paid the tipping ransom first, and crossed the subcontinent to Bombay. At least Bombay was western looking, geographically if no other way. Bombay was just as bad as Calcutta. I soon discovered that there were import and export rules by the hundred. Most Western countries have this type of regulation. But here in Bombay the government had run riot with hundreds of them, each succeeding one more onerous than the previous one. If I could have entered into a business arrangement, then I found out that I would spend all my time making out endless lists, filling in countless forms, paying out duty and tax that would have beggared a philanthropic society, and I represented a business concern. After I had spent a couple of days in Bombay and I'd had time to size up the situation, I realized that I was getting nowhere fast. All these restrictions were understandable in the light of India's recently won independence. She was still suffering from the mistrust of the alien, the suspicion of the undesirable foreigner. I gave up the unequal struggle, reflecting that it was pointless trying to do business in these circumstances. Every penny invested would have been at risk. The threat of nationalization was such that a businessman was always on the lookout for a means of escape, even though that escape might involve a last despairing jump from a high window. Once I had made this decision, I felt a lot better in myself. I turned the business trip into a holiday, cabling my office to say that the business trip was off but the pleasure trip was on. That's the best of being the boss, you can make your own decisions and there's nobody to dispute them. In the same way that I had mingled with the crowds in Calcutta, so tea now mixed with the throngs of Bombay, I remembered I lag from my school days, when we had been studying the works of Mark Twain. The famous American humorist had remarked about the bejeweled natives of India. Things must have changed since his day, for although I saw any amount of native Indians, I saw precious few jewels. Even in the hotels that I visited, jewels were conspicuous by their absence. The handful of faded old ladies who haunted such places aired nothing but their memories. I decided that the only way to see the real India, the India that is ignored by the tourists, was to travel the whole length of the country by tram, going third class in order to study the natives at first hand. So I bought a ticket for Madras, down on the southeast coast, paid my hotel bill, handed out the inevitable backsheesh, and set out for the south, ruefully thinking that the whole trip had been one ghastly failure. Again, Mark Twain was brought to my mind. He had spoken about the charm and delight of traveling by train in India. Indeed, he had so rhapsodized about it, that he had asserted that the delight of it was beyond words. Once more, things must have changed since his day. There was one excellent word for it, smell. I had hardly settled in my compartment before I became aware of the smell. It was not the bottle of scotch that I immediately uncorked once the train had started. That in itself was no mean feat, not the train's starting, but the fact that I had a bottle of scotch to uncork. It is very difficult for anybody to get hold of whiskey in India, but as one was an overseas visitor, I had been lucky. Thanks to the British, it is possible to travel pretty well everywhere in India. But as I discovered, though you can travel far and wide, you can't escape from the smell. If one has to love humanity, then in India one also has to learn how to love, and live with halitosis. I left Bombay on the 10th of October, 1964. In the 10 days that I had spent trying to do business in Calcutta and Bombay, I had achieved precisely nothing. That was, I suppose, the reason for my pessimism, but I looked forward to the long rail journey, for it would give me the opportunity to see a great deal of this enormous country. The British, I understood, had handed over the railways in fair nick to the Indian authorities. However, what with one thing and another, maintenance had not been quite so good since independence as it had been before. Accidents do occur a little more frequently, and the people who travel look upon them as an occupational hazard. Some extremely nervous, or cautious, travelers take all steps possible to make sure that as far as possible everything is in order. But they are the exception and not the rule. Never is the national characteristic of fatalism more evident in India than when traveling by train. Judge my surprise, then, when I noticed my traveling companion make a careful check of everything in the compartment. It was this eccentricity that made me notice him. The man was obviously a Sahib left over from the British occupation. He was very well dressed, and had the unmistakable stamp of authority in his bearing, but he himself checked the door handle and lock, the windows, and tested the seals as though he was of a very nervous disposition and quite unaccustomed to making a long railway journey. When he had tested everything to his satisfaction, my companion took the seat opposite me.